Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like an ancient manuscript.
Okay, elaborate.
Yeah. Well, you know, like in fancy language. In fancy language, I'm feeling like a palimpsest, which is actually a manuscript or a piece of writing which has had kind of older writing, maybe like hundreds of years ago, and then it's been erased perhaps, and then new writing has been placed on top. But you kind of have the echo of the earlier, like, effaced writing. And
Who erased it?
Well, I don't know. It could have been you, I would expect, because you are quite...
I would never erase anything that's 400 years old, trust me, and then write on it.
Rebellious. But today's guest's work, the reason I'm feeling this way is because today's guest's work has, over the past kind of few decades, evolved into something a bit like a palimpsest, in the sense of adding, taking away within their paintings. And the surface, I feel like, has become more and more and more important, and the kind of layers and history within the making. And often the works can take many years to be created and to come to fruition. And I was first familiar with the work when I was really young, when I was about 25. And back then, he was making work that was kind of more like figurative in a way, not like realist, but kind of with figures, and often like illuminated kind of figures. And there was this kind of luminous, incredible use of light and still texture, actually, which is where the works have kind of gone to. But I also feel like he's been a kind of constant through my journey in the art world. And I know that he's inspired so many young artists who are now not so young, actually. They're probably like more like mid-career artists. But I know that he's been both a kind of educator, an ally, a friend to so many painters, particularly at a time when painting wasn't as popular. It kind of fell out of favor at one point, in a way. And I think he's always been a real champion for painting and has encouraged so many people. Like, literally, I could name about 30 artists that will quote his name to me over the years. And he's someone that we've both wanted to have on the show for years, and I'm glad we finally made it. And we're doing this show now. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Tim Stoner. Hi, Tim.
Hello. That was an amazing intro.
bit long-winded.
How can I follow up that? I mean, you know, it's you kind of said it all there. I'm kind of knocked out.
Should we just go to our final questions then?
yeah. Anyway, people, thanks for listening.
Thank you. Yeah, art highest favorite color. Bye.
The thing is, Tim, it's true, because I feel like you've inspired so many people, and I don't really know if that's like acknowledged or not at the moment. But I'm really conscious of it. There's so many painters that will like. Even recently, we interviewed Pam Evelyn, and Pam was talking about you. And I've worked in the past with David Brian Smith, and David always spoke about you. And I could just keep going. Like, there's so many people that love your work, and I feel like you've been a real champion and kind of propelled people forwards in their painting. How do you feel about that statement?
Wow. I mean, first of all, I'm really flattered because, you know, to hear my name's mentioned in a nice way. Look, I really think that the whole life that you have being an artist, you know, and teaching and this sort of weird generational thing, you know, that you're one minute you're young and everyone's in front of you, and then you're kind of middle-aged and there's loads of people behind you. But you're part of this conversation that actually you realise isn't just about the living. You know, you can have a conversation with Giotto and he's been dead for 700 years.
Yeah.
And I think that the legacy, I mean, I really enjoyed teaching when I did it. I don't teach anymore, but I think having studied in Europe as well and seen the difference in what it means to be in that conversation and how that conversation works and the way that the hierarchies are a little bit different, I think that's sort of really interesting. And I mean, actually, I talk to a lot of younger painters at the moment, and I think that's for two reasons. One, because I think there's a lot of very good painting going on, actually, particularly in London. It's kind of like, wow. Mm. And then also because, like, you want to stay in the loop. You know, I don't just want to be some... I don't play golf, right? You know, I'm not that kind of guy. I'm kind of interested in, like, what's going on out there. And whether it's people who are still at college or people who have just left, I think it's good to... Or painters that... I mean, I was talking to Basil Beattie the other evening, and, you know, he's 88, and... You know, that massive respect for that guy. And I think that, you know, it's like painting. You're just so lucky to be alive in the moment and be able to have those conversations and make a painting.
Why do you think there is a lot of good painting going on right now?
I tell you what, Russell, it's really weird. I remember when I was in my 20s and there was like a real... kind of crisis around this. You know, I was thinking earlier, like, who were the biggest artists when I was in my 20s? And they were people like Barbara Kruger, and, you know, and people who are good artists. I mean, people who taught me, like Dan Graham, who hated painting. I mean, like a lunatic, frankly. But I remember having to fight against something in the 90s. You know, I don't think it's like that now. I think it's much more open. I think people can be coming from things at many different angles. You know, I mean, I think there's a different conceptual outlook now than there was then, because you had to have a kind of level of rigor then. I mean, particularly if you're sort of having an argument with someone like Dan Graham. But for me, I decided to go and study in the Netherlands when I was in my sort of mid-late 20s, because I wasn't a YBA artist.
Did you want to be? Or did you feel like you were on a periphery of it? Or
no, I just it just wasn't me. I mean, I think there were some really good artists in the YBA thing, you know, and there were people who were kind of dragged into it that I'd studied at the Royal College with, like Chris Afili. And, you know, Chris is a serious work. He's got the most insane work ethic I've ever come across, frankly. So I didn't have anything against it in that way. I just wasn't wanting to make art in that framework. And, you know, what was really funny was that when I went to the Netherlands, everyone only talked to me about YBA. I mean, I remember my first tutorial with Luke Timons, and he just wouldn't shut up about it. And I just kind of thought, look, piss off. I came here to get away from that.
And you were a bit younger than that as well, weren't you? Because if you think of, like, weren't you like 1970 were you born?
Yeah, but I mean, like, Darren Armand's younger than me, and there's one or two others. And I mean, I suppose the clue's in the name. Yeah. Now I'm an OBA. but
wasn't Nick Toyman's a fan of it, or was he talking about it in a negative way?
I don't want to speak for Luke. That's okay. Dangerous.
That's but amazing that it was part of the conversation, that people were so aware of it as a movement.
Well,
that it
Emma
was
Dexter
up for discussion.
Came over and did a talk at the Rijksacademy, and I was just looked at her like, oh, please don't do this.
Who was
Emma Dexter? Emma Dexter, who was the curator at the ICA, and Luke was sort of heckling quite a lot. And it all kind of got a bit out of control, like most things at the Rijksacademy did. No, I sort of felt like there's this René Daniels painting called Mr. North Sea. And I sort of felt like that. I wasn't really Dutch and I wasn't really kind of English at that point. And when I came back here, everyone said my paintings looked really Dutch, and everyone in Holland thought my paintings looked really English. But they didn't realise at the time that was only part of my plan, which was that I wanted to live in the three places where, you know, painting kind of came from, and that included Spain and Italy. So I was only kind of halfway there at that point.
Wow. When did you make that? What age did you make that decision to know that that was geographically how you were going to position yourself?
Oh, that's a question for the psychologist.
It's quite an incredible insight to have at an early age that you're like, I want to straddle these three locations. I don't think we've ever talked to anyone who's ever thought about that from such a young age.
Well, I look, as you know, Russell, I grew up in Leytonstone and
Essex boy. Yeah.
Well, I know I was born in
London
Essex
borders, and, but yeah.
But no, I am an Essex boy.
Good.
We've had this conversation before.
Yeah.
I remembered, you know, art schools used to be full of the weird kids that didn't fit in, right? Mm. Now they're full of the rich kids. But what I loved in the old days was whether the person was from Grimsby or Eton, you know, they were always the weird kid. and art schools were a place where all the weirdos met each other. And I was probably like that, you know. I didn't used to kind of go out and be a teenager. I used to sit in my bedroom and kind of memorize Monet paintings and, you know, I was obsessed with painting. And I even used to do paintings of like Spanish mountainscapes in my bedroom in Leytonstone. Mm. I mean, I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know what that was all about. But I kind of, by looking at art history, realized that at least within European painting, which is kind of, you know, let's face it, where I am. And I love American painting and I love art now that's made all over the world. But at that time, because I was looking so specifically, you know, painting from, I don't know, like the Middle Ages up until the 19th century, you couldn't avoid Rome, Amsterdam and Madrid.
Where was you getting the information from? Was it books from the library? I mean, and this is like the 80s, is it? This is the early 80s.
Yeah, early mid 80s, yeah. Well, it's weird. I mean, I come from a sort of quite, my family aren't art people. Like my dad ran a union with, you know, Alan Johnson, and my mum ran a women's refuge, and my sister Lucy, she's just got back from Syria. She's like been an aid worker out there.
Oh my God.
And so like I'm le petit bourgeoisie, you know, I'm like the, you know, I'm like the, like, oh, here he comes.
I could argue that one on your behalf though, because I feel like you're feeding our like need for cultural kind of input. So it's still just as valid, I think, as it's like still humanitarian, just in a different way, because you're keeping our souls alive, which is just as important sometimes.
I mean, I haven't got any kind of mad ideas about what art can do, because when you have a family like that and, you know, the topics are strikes, woman beaters and death. Mm. It's like, right, I know that making this painting isn't going to change that. And I mean, look, you know, Guernica is a brilliant painting. It's my favourite painting of the 20th century. But let's face it, if the aim of Guernica was to stop war, it failed.
It didn't work. Yeah.
No, but that doesn't mean that's not a problem for Guernica. It's a problem for humanity.
Yeah. How did you find art then? How did that come into your life? And was a viable option for you to think, I can make a career at this?
I thought about this really a lot. I think I said to you in a message that when I went to school, I was the only person doing art. And I had this brilliant art teacher, Kath Trotter, at Leighton Boys School. And she kind of took me under her wing. And one day the careers advisor came in and I said, I want to be an artist, you know. And he said, can you write? And I said, yeah. And he said, can you carve? And I was like, yeah. And he said, right, you should be a tombstone carver. And it was like, that was the extent of like expectations from somebody from a kind of working class background that's what they would do. And, you know, I'm sure in more salubrious schools than the one that I went to, they wouldn't be told to do that. But you had to kind of fight with it. And I even had people in my family calling me a class traitor for wanting to do art, you know, and some of them worked at Ford's in Dagenham. And I kind of thought, well, I mean, I remember one of them saying, why do you want to be an artist? Nobody cares what you're doing until you're dead. And I said, well, why do you want to put windscreens in cars for 40 years, you know? And I wasn't being a chippy snob about it. I was just like, basically growing up, having to fight to say, look, this is what I want to do. And if you don't like it, sling your hook. So I think part of it came out of that. And, you know, I mean, I remember lots of hostility. And I just think that made me, because of my temperament, kind of want it maybe a little bit more. And also art was this kind of weird thing, isn't it? It's like, I love music. Like I'm probably more obsessed with music than painting. And I listen to loads of music podcasts. But I never picked an instrument up because I never wanted music to be about me. I wanted to enjoy it, right? I didn't want my authorship to be conflated with my love for music. But with art, I just made that decision. Yeah, you know, it's all about me now.
That's so interesting. Well, that's how I feel about art. And Rob, we always get asked, like, do you want to make art? And it's like, no, I love artists and my heroes.
I totally
and they're on pedestals,
that.
And I don't ever want to feel like I'm like in competition or in some sort of discourse with an artist or like a visual artist. Mm-hmm. I love to keep them separate.
And the wonder of it, I think that encourages the wonder as well. Yeah. Like, not because I can't even really draw, you know, it's like, you know, it's so magical somehow.
Well, it is. I mean, I went to a talk John Curran did very early on at the Royal College, and he was talking about sort of comparing his age to Picasso. It was actually really funny, sort of like going, oh, God, he was 32 when he did that, and now I'm 33, sort of thing. And, you know, I saw the Mirandi show the other day, which is just absolutely incredible. I think it might have finished, and I was so relieved that he was like 70 and stuff like that. I was like, oh, thanks, mate.
I've got time.
Yeah,
I used to do that with my career. Yeah, I used to go like, well, that actor's 30 and they're doing that and I'm 20. I said, right, I've got 10 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's all right. Chill. Just keep going.
Whereas I had like a 20-year-old crisis when I turned 20. I thought I was finished because I was making pop music and that was the age. And I literally had a breakdown at the age of 20 thinking I'd failed because I've been doing it since I was 13. Isn't that tragic?
That's too much pressure. I mean,
yeah.
I always kind of thought, right, you know, let's give it till you're 50. And I mean, part of my thing as well was that I sort of had a bit of a meltdown with all of that in my early 30s, really. And I pissed off and moved up a mountain in Spain. And I remember going to an opening at a gallery whose name I won't mention, but you know who you are, mate, and one of London's biggest gallerists, and he poked me in the chest and he said, you've disappeared, you're finished, you're over. And I had to go back up my mountain in Spain, which, you know, you could hear sheep bleating outside the door, and really, really work through it. And I did that for the best part of 20 years. And, of course, everybody thought I was completely bonkers. People that I worked with at the time were like, you know, you can't do that. And I just, the more that people told me that I couldn't do it, the more I was determined to do it. And, yeah, I mean, in terms of what you said about a career, doing something like that is not a good career move. But as far as I'm concerned,
but why? No, why would that not be a good career? If you're making the work and the work is getting out there in the world, why would it matter where you're located?
The work wasn't getting out there in the world at the time, and there was no social media, and I couldn't even get a telephone line installed because the Spanish telephone company just really couldn't be bothered to do it in rural Andalusia. I think they were installing telephone lines in Guatemala, but they wouldn't put them on the bit of Spain where I lived. And I mean, the isolation was kind of bonkers. And, you know, my studio sort of 100 metres away from where David Bomberg painted. And you imagine what it was like for him in kind of like, you know, the 30s and 50s when he painted.
Who was David Bomberg then?
I've actually been looking at his painting a lot recently.
David Bomberg is now an incredibly sought-after artist, and he's really one of the trailblazers of British figurative painting. He started off as a vaulticist, and he was at the Slade, but he got thrown out for hitting a tutor with a palette. And he was a street fighting Cockney. He was one of the I think they're called the Whitechapel Boys. Mark Gertler, him, and I can't remember who the other one was. But they used to fight the black shirts. They were Jewish, and they used to knock around Brick Lane having sort of fist fights, and then he'd go to studio and paint. And he ended up in southern Spain, and I actually know people that knew him. One guy told me that he used to carry Bomberg's paintings on the back of his donkey for him.
Wow.
And people used to come out of their shops in Rhondda and clap the donkeys as they went past.
No way.
Yeah. that's what you call art transport.
Yeah. So you were located, sorry, what were you going to say, Rob?
I was going to say, is Bomberg one of the reasons you thought of Andalusia? Like, because I know that this place, Rhondda, became such an important kind of place for you, but... What was it that drew you there? I'm so fascinated. Were there like Spanish painters as well? Or?
Well, you know, it's a really weird thing, Robert, that actually, if you look at the history of painting, what's peculiar about Spain is it doesn't really have a history of landscape painting.
Yeah.
There are great landscapes by El Greco. El Greco, of course, being the Greek, being a giddy like me, a foreigner. And Spanish landscape painting itself, I've seen some really good Miro's landscapes and some Picasso landscapes, but all the people that have been going there since the 18th century and doing paintings of the Sierra de Rhondda and Andalusia, they're all like Scottish and English. And I think Leonora Carrington went down there, but she was sort of nearer Granada, Bomberg, Miles Richmond, who's a brilliant painter. And I've got friends there at the moment. It's just a really sort of amazing landscape. It's like, you know, where the Italian landscape is very rolling and pastoral, and Spanish landscape looks like it's just been smashed to bits. And it turns out that's the truth. When Africa hit the European continent, the bit of Spain where I live just kind of got the impact, and it's like kind of splintered rock. So it's a fascinating place to live and to see things. And the light is extraordinary.
How long were you there then? 20? Did you say 20 well, years? No.
Well, I've been 20 years on and off, but...
Wow.
Yeah, there was that little thing that happened called Brexit.
Yeah, you're an artist that's definitely been affected by Brexit.
You know what, Russell? It's like, I mean... Everyone's got an opinion on it, and it's not for me to want to change anybody's mind. You know, everyone's welcome to their own opinion. But for me, it was like something got kind of stolen from me. Mm. You know, going from my bedroom in Leytonstone, painting Spanish mountains out of my imagination, then living in them. And one of the reasons Robert mentioned my earlier work was that when I first went there, I tried to continue with that work. And then one day I opened the door and there's this furnace of bright light where it's just white, and then gradually you start seeing the shapes of the mountains and everything, and you hear the bird song, and you think, God, if I could get 1% of that in a painting, it would be really good. And why am I trying to do what I was doing in Bethnal Green in Rhondda? Well, ironically, I'm in Bethnal Green now and I'm painting Rhondda, so I don't know what that means. But
how did you stay focused? It was quite a solitary practice you had. What was your routine? Did you have like a 9-to-5? What were your rules you set for yourself to kind of keep that focus, if you're feeling cut off from everyone and people at home are saying, you're missing from the art world. How do you and did you maintain your practice?
That's a brilliant question because, you know, I think most painters that will be listening to this podcast will realize and know that painting is like a sort of weird prison sentence anyway. And that, you know, it's one of the most individualistic and most endeavors that there is in the world. And I never have been a 9-to-5 person. I think if you can have all the talent in the world, but if you can't stand your own company, you can't be an artist. And I, you know, me being me, I just sort of really wanted to test it. And you know what? I destroyed most of the work that I'm, some paintings I wish I had destroyed, lots and lots of paintings. I mean, I then worked in a studio in Marbella for about 4 or 5 years down on the coast, and I used to walk along the beach to get to it, and it was like ridiculously nice. So that kind of made it a little bit easier. But all of that work ended up being destroyed. I wasn't painting to make art objects. I wasn't painting to satisfy a desire for having a painting on the wall. I was trying to satisfy playing out all of the potential applications and possibilities of both how I was experiencing and seeing the world, but also how I was imagining it. And, you know, most of the time you miss the target. And the worst thing actually is that sometimes you hit it and you don't see it. And one of the things that was really good in the end was that I was painting in here in Bethnal Green, and then I'd leave paintings, go to Spain for like 6 months or a year. And when I came back, I realized that everything that was in the studio was finished. Whereas if I'd have just stayed here, I'd have just carried on painting over it. So there was this weird synchronicity that came out of this.
It's quite a conceptual practice you had for a while then, where it was the doing, it wasn't the end product, the process.
I it's funny because I sort of, one of the things I know, I mean, as I say, I don't teach now, but one of the things that I noticed, particularly around conversations in painting schools, is there isn't a lot of conversation about conceptual art. Now, I'm not a conceptual artist and I don't have any ambition to be a conceptual artist, but having been taught by people, you know, people who used to come into the Rights Academy, you know, I mean, the kind of names were ridiculous. Pistoletto, Joan Jonas, Dan Graham. Luke was quite good with all of that, but he never talked about that to painting students. But what was imbued in you from being in that kind of environment was this idea that even if you didn't want to make art like that, you had to have some kind of concept of the conceptual.
Got it.
Which I did. And I mean, I had so many rows with Dan Graham. It was kind of comedic. He'd kind of yell at me that painting was just camouflage. And I mean, for me, that was like the most mind-blowing comment that I ever heard. And it came from somebody who, like, in every atom of their body hated painting. But it made me go and look at kind of dazzle art, which is like ship design camouflage. And, you know, and there's all this sort of amazing, you think, yeah, your painting is camouflage. Although when I said to him that his glass sculptures look like corporate foyers, he blew up.
Oh my God. How did you get in there? What was the process of coming from Leytonstone and going to art school in Amsterdam at one of the best art schools in the globe?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it was because when I was at the Royal College, I did two things. One was a sort of transfer, and I went to Lisbon and I studied at the Arco Art Academy there for a little bit. And that was quite funny because A.R. Penck was running the painting class and he threw me out of it, which I don't know. I never knew why. And then I went to Berlin on an Erasmus, and I walked into the class of Hudecker and Koebling, and I just thought, really like your paintings, but like every student in here is like making your work. So I was with a friend, and we just got on a train and went to Dresden, and didn't stop traveling. So I'd already kind of done that, and when I left the Royal College, I'd kind of gone round Europe and gone to all the museums and done really what I wish I'd have done before I went to Royal College. And then a few people that I knew applied to the Rights Academy, and I thought, I'm going to give it a go. And there's another program there called the Ateliers program, and I thought, well, I'll give them both a shot. And I got an interview at the Rights Academy, and I was actually living in southern Spain at the time. It just sounds mad now. And I think I went to Morocco, and I sort of phoned home, and they went, you've got to be in Amsterdam.
Wow.
All right, okay, I'll go.
You just mentioned the Erasmus. It doesn't exist anymore because of Brexit, but that is an art exchange thing where we would have students here, and then you would be able to travel, and it was a grant, wasn't it?
Well, it was a really, really important part of what being within the EU meant, really. It isn't just all about trade as an exchange. It's about the exchange of ideas. And, when you think, all the way back to the 16th century, like Thomas More was having conversations with Erasmus. So,
And Holbein wasn't Hans Holbein.
Yeah, exactly. All the great British painters of royalty are all Flemish or German or Swiss.
True. So true.
And so for me, I mean, it felt like a kind of personal wound when all that happened. And I remembered phoning a lawyer up and him telling me, because I went to Spain during the second lockdown, because as soon as the first lockdown ended, I thought, right, not having any more of this. So I got on a plane, I went to Spain. And, in Spain, everybody was so obedient to it. I mean, I don't know if it was because of the Franco period, people just do what they're told, but they really, really stuck by the rules. And, I mean, my next door neighbour was in the massive field, like half a kilometre from anybody, wearing a mask. And it was kind of almost, like, hilarious. But I went there, and I stuck out the second lockdown in Spain and worked on some paintings there. And I remembered phoning this lawyer and him saying, well, Mr. Stoner, you're an illegal immigrant now. I was kind of like, what? It's sort of like you don't – I mean, obviously I don't think of myself as a, white – English man as being an illegal immigrant, but suddenly that's what I was. And so I tried to see the funny side of it, because I kind of got all the anger out of the way before. I won't go on about that because it was horrible. And I tried to sort of keep it light, but it's still, niggling away at me. And I think that what's kind of strange for me now is that, I have a load of unfinished paintings in my studio in Spain, some of them like 3 by 4 meters. I mean, I might go back and decide that they're finished, but I'm making paintings still about Spain here in London. And you go through this really weird process, because when you're in the place, it's like you're enveloped by your subject matter. And when you leave it, you sort of miss it. And then there's this sort of weird thing of having nostalgia for it. Mm. And then there's this other thing that creeps up on you, which is a kind of weird resentment about your subject matter being physically taken away from you. So the paintings are now coming out of this really fractious place, which is kind of weird because I think they're getting better. So I don't know whether Brexit was a good thing
or not. So you're working from
tension in it,
memory, imagination, but are you also working from paintings you've made while you were there and you're overworking them, or photographs? What are the sources for your images?
It's really complicated, Russell. I mean, I've been thinking about when I was a teenager making paintings and what I wanted to do then. There's this great Hopper quote. I can't say it verbatim, but he said something like, when you're a mature artist, you're a mature painter, you're more like the artist you were as a teenager than the one that was corrupted by art school. And I realised that there was this sort of process of catharsis that, you know, luckily when I left the Royal College, I did things like I did a community arts project, voluntary work in a housing estate in Walthamstow doing a mosaic. And I cut the link. And I think when I went to Spain, I really severed it. But weirdly, when you're a painter, things are cyclic. And what happened was that things were becoming repeated from a younger part of me. Mm. And I had to kind of decide whether to embrace them or avoid them. So in terms of your question, there were things like, I always had this idea that I'd like to just have canvases on the wall and pick up a brush and paint without anything. You know, to me, that would be like the ultimate, you know, like the way that Joan Mitchell does it or Lee Krasner, you know, they're just so epic at that. And, you know, because I think that painting is about this weird struggle of finding liberation within a kind of lots of rules and limitations. And so I really wanted to feel more liberated. So what I did, and this comes back to a conversation that I had a lot at the Rijksacademy, and at the Rijksacademy, the conversation in the painting school was predominantly like this, that there were two types of painting, that you either did that kind of painting where you had this sort of free energy to just apply yourself, which in the 90s did look kind of problematic as well. Or what you did, like somebody like Timons, maybe Malena Dumas, etc., is you make a template, you make a kind of model, you get everything where you want it in this, by model, I mean drawing or plan or watercolor or whatever, mm-hmm. and then you replicate that, right? So there's these two modes of activity. One is the artist as a replicator of something, and the other is as a kind of imaginatory sort of drifter. And for me, I've always been kind of in between those two things. I find the idea of copying myself worse than the idea of me copying anyone else or of anyone else copying me.
So you don't have a sketchbook then? You just
Since I came back from Spain 2 years ago,
yeah,
I've made 300 works on paper, paintings on paper mainly, and they're like a kind of archive for me. And the archive is more interesting when it becomes cerebral rather than when I'm standing there holding a thing in front of me and then trying to replicate it.
Right.
And at the beginning, I will kind of like be doing that. But when you leave something and then go back to it, and then that happens several times, and then you're painting without that thing and your familiarity with it is much more kind of psychological, then I think the painting opens up in a completely different way. And the process of removing paint and returning back to an earlier version of oneself, the idea of kind of eviscerating bits of the painting and playing this thing where you're sort of adding and subtracting in the painting, it enriches that idea of that exploration, I think.
I was thinking about that a minute ago, about how you were talking about all those paintings that you'd made in Spain and then you destroyed them all, but how even though you have destroyed them all, I feel like they must still be within you.
Yeah.
Like there's some kind of like imprint in your brain that like you, and also you might almost long for them somehow because you know they've gone, and therefore they reappear in other works. And that's really like profoundly like exciting somehow. I find it really like, I don't know, there's something quite sort of magical and fucked up about it.
Well, I work in a studio in on the other side of London as well, where I live.
Oh yeah, can we talk about that? So you've got one in Stockwell and one in Bethnal Green. You're like south and east. What is that about? I saw that earlier.
My life is just a little bit kind of mad.
Is it because you need the distance for that? You need to leave paintings alone and go somewhere else and then come back?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And there I wake up with them, which is like, I can't remember if I've ever done that before. And it's really intense, like when you wake up. And the thing is, it's the smaller studio, and I've actually got three paintings in there that are massive. And one of them I started in 2009 in Marbella. And it sort of followed me around. And I removed a layer of paint off of it recently, and a face was there from an incarnation of an earlier painting. And it was kind of like...
It's archaeological, like a dig. Like all these artifacts of your past suddenly appearing.
I felt like
that
Tony Robinson.
Yeah. Time Hunt, or whatever. Is that what it's called? Time Team. Time Team, that's it.
I kind of sat for ages with that. And I, you know, what I realised was that there's these weird things that happen where you put things in a new version of a painting where you didn't realise you'd put them before, because that's just the way you're inclined. And when you go backwards and you see that, it reaffirms that. But also my kind of mad thing that I'm always talking to people about is that I think paintings are time machines. Like, I don't want to sound like some kind of like lunatic, but they are in every sense of the word time machines. You know, when you see, you know, a Holbein painting of Thomas More or whatever, it's like it is the nearest you're going to get to that character of that person. You know, all the CGI in the world and all the cinematography of all the greatest directors, and the hand is involved in it, you know. And, you know, my favourite thing said about this was by Jakub Bronowski, and he said, you know, the hand is the cutting edge of the mind. And I think if you, whether you're in the Scriveni Chapel in Padua looking at the Giotto frescoes, or whether you're, you know, looking at a de Kooning painting, or, you know, like I was saying about the Krasner paintings, you know, and that show that they had that was amazing. That's what it's really about. And they are like time machines. But all I'm doing is that I'm kind of doing a dissection of my own paintings over this long period.
It's an autopsy, isn't it, in some ways?
It is a painted autopsy.
Yeah.
And going back to this earlier version of myself that weirdly I didn't, most of the time, I'll remove a bit of painting and the colour that's better than the one that I would have thought of putting there on top is there. And it's like playing this weird game with accident and chance, but an accident and a chance that you created for yourself on the other side of Europe 10 years earlier.
So how do you know to let them go then? When you're working on some of these things for as long as like 12 years, how do you know when it's ready to release from the studio to go out and be collected?
Do you know what? The thing about painting, I've talked to so many painters about this, because I think finishing a painting, It's really like the thing that all painters kind of like walk around sort of agonizing over. And I really wish I was like those guys like Edward Hopper or Timons or Alex Katz or Avigdor Rica, who know that they're going to do it in one go. And when they walk away from the canvas, that's it. And if it's not finished, it goes in the bin and they do it again the next day, right? So they've kind of got a system that kind of protects them for that. For me, it's like a completely different ball game.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card.
Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
So two things happen. One, I try and sell myself the idea that a painting might be finished, right? And the thing is, the longer you do it and the more you become self-aware and the more you look at your own work, which can cloud your judgment, but the more that you do that, the less you can bullshit yourself into believing that something's finished. And I always start off with that Leonardo thing. Things are never finished, they're just abandoned, or things just left, you know. I think he said something like that. So I try that one, and then the thing sits there and sits. And there were two paintings in my other studio that I thought were finished, and I got them out the other day, and I just called myself a coward. And I thought, right, there's about another 5 years going on
here. What's the longest you've worked on a painting?
I think there's probably... It depends. I mean, like, there was one painting that I did that I started in 2007. I rolled it up in 2010. It went on the top of my storage shelf for 10 years. And when I took it down, I finished it. And it was the same painting, but finished, right? But there was like 10 years sort of settling down period where like my ego and my authorship had to be kind of like completely removed from this thing for me to be able to see it with a level of clarity. Mm. Other times there are paintings that are always around you, always kind of making your life a pain in the arse. And there's paintings are so weird. I mean, there's some paintings that just literally paint themselves and you think, right, now I've nailed it. And you haven't, right? That'll be like one in 10 paintings. And then there'll be the main group of them that are a bit, well, it is difficult, end of. But you kind of navigate it with all of the skill sets and things that you've got. But that won't finish the painting. What will finish the painting is usually something that you're not sure about. I mean, Lucian Freud used to say, you know, that he said you slave over a painting for months and years and then you suddenly turn a corner and it's there. I always thought that was a really brilliant way of putting it.
But you're saying you don't feel that. You have to bullshit yourself that you feel that, or you
if
do.
If I'm lucky, that does happen, but they all finish themselves in different ways. I mean, there's a story of Joshua Reynolds going to... I've never been a Joshua Reynolds fan, and when I heard this story, I just thought, you thug. He bought a Titian painting. And
no, it's Rubens. That was Rubens.
Well,
I was
told it was Rubens, but somebody then recently said to me that it was Reynolds.
Oh, okay.
And I
carry
always
on,
thought it was
on.
Rubens
the
buying
the
painting
so
in Antwerp. Yeah, but somebody said recently to me that I was wrong. So I hope you are right. But yeah, the painting was scraped back so that the artist could understand how Titian had manufactured the painting. And
yeah, he bought it and flayed it.
That's right.
Titian painting just to see the process of it so he could see how it was made, which is just such a what's the word?
I can't even find a word for that. But it's like that Japanese collector who wants to be cremated with his Van Gogh, you know.
Well, he wants to burn the painting with it.
Yeah. They had to change the law in Japan so that he didn't do it.
Oh, wow, I'd never heard of that.
Yeah,
that's mental.
Yeah, he's like a billionaire. And people get like that about paintings, you know. I mean, it's a kind of addiction, isn't it? It's an addiction for you guys as much as it is for me, Ben, just in a different way. I'm just the supplier.
You're the dealer.
Yeah,
but you're
giving
us our hit. There's an amazing essay on your website by Martin Herbert. It's incredibly beautiful. And there is a section in it where he says that the artist has to make mistakes or change his mind in order to create something to dig into, to generate a rich loam for his spade. And what we're talking about, these are a series of mistakes, I guess, good mistakes, and changing your mind. But that is the process that you've made for yourself. You could never do a painting in one sitting and let it go, could you?
Sometimes I try, and it's complicated because, you know, I am quite good at doing that kind of painting. I mean, you don't paint every day for 37 years and not have certain a box of tricks here and there. And, you know, my problem is that I probably got too many boxes with too many tricks. So I can do that kind of painting, and I have actually kept paintings that I've made like that, particularly when I was a student in the Netherlands. But there's something about it that never really satisfied me. And I think, you know, the people that do that, they do it for the right reasons and it's their territory. And I'm not interested in sort of helping anyone else out in their territory. I'm kind of about my territory. And my territory is just like full of kind of bananas situations with paintings where I'm getting stuff now to find out how I can literally return the painting to bare canvas so that I can have these really claggy, overworked kind of bits that have driven me mad next to kind of like nothing. And, you know, I'm really about those extremes at the moment between the kind of the viscerality of that. And the thing about Martin is that he was the person, I mean, I've talked to Martin for more than 20 years. You know, he's been one of the most important people that I've spoken to about my work. And Martin was really the person that basically sort of said to me, look, you're painting this landscape, right? But actually what you're also doing is that you're making a landscape on the painting that is made in the same way as the landscape. And if you think about particularly the landscape where I live in Spain, the way that it's been, you know, carved up and farmed and, you know, the way agriculture works on it. And there's loads of vineyards where I live, olive trees everywhere. And then you think about painting, you start realizing that making a paint in that place isn't just about making a depiction about it. Mm. It's about having those layers of and that richness. And also my neighbors, right? I mean, Spanish people in general, I've found they really understand where their food comes from. They're not like, you know, they're not like English people who think that a chicken is something you find in a bargain bucket. They like my neighbors grow all of their food or farm all of their food, and they're really, and it really sort of taught me about the land a bit and, you know, having a different respect for nature. And I think the big change in my life since I did the work that Robert cited at the beginning and through my conversations with Martin is my absolute belief and love of nature, which when I made those early paintings, I had a very sort of what I would call conceptual synthetic idea of nature. And I think the paintings had quite a sort of synthetic or conceptual idea of nature. Whereas now, yeah, I hope I'm becoming a bit more sensitive.
Do you feel like you're back in the art world? You know, you said you had this guy, this dealer, prod you in the chest and say you've left, you're finished. Do you feel like you've returned and you are part of the discourse and the discussions that are happening now?
Well, first of all, I don't conflate the conversations that I have with other artists with the art world. I don't believe that the market knows what's going on and it isn't something that particularly interests me. I got into art, like I said, being a teenager, looking at books on Impressionism. And, you know, if somebody had said to me then, what's the art world? I just said, oh, wasn't that when Cezanne and Pizarro went for a walk? and the thing is,
I love that so much.
I actually think that I think that now.
It's true.
And that's why I said I'm becoming more like I was when I was a teenager. Look, I have lots of conversations with lots of other painters that no one else is party to. And there is a really interesting conversation going on that isn't at the Frieze Art Fair and isn't really represented. And I'm not working with a gallery at the moment, and I'm doing that for so many reasons, and I'm doing that because I want to come in the studio and look at what I'm doing with a level of, I used the word clarity before, but ownership, you know, like really living through it. I don't want somebody saying to me, is this painting going to be finished for blah, 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 blah. It's like, look, you know, it's like, no. So I do.
The thing is, you've also like lived your life like that though. I feel like that's the way you make work. You know what I mean? Like it's kind of like you need that to exist, like that freedom in a sense.
It's totally at odds with the artist's most important preoccupation, which is survival.
Is there a worry for survival? Is there a panic for?
I do you know what?
You have about 1,000 studios everywhere. It's like.
Yeah, wasn't I think I read something. I think it was a Duke of Wellington. No, well, maybe it wasn't the Duke of Wellington. He said a gentleman should never live within his means. And I kind of thought, well, all right.
I'm writing that one down. My mum would be like, that's you. Okay.
The thing is, though, Tim, like, I feel like when Russell says about survival, he was obviously talking about kind of like, you know, the fact the studio is expensive, all this stuff, but on a monetary kind of level in a way. But for you to survive, that's kind of my point. I feel like you have to make work and make art. And that's ever since you've been a teenage lad. Mm. You've like, it's your way of existing in the world, isn't it? Like to paint, to think about painting, to talk about painting with other painters. It's kind of like that is your survival. So the other stuff's just peripheral in a sense.
Oh, it is. But, you know, like I said, you know, I think the only people who probably have the solitude that artists have got are either prisoners or monks. You know, we've probably all got quite a lot in common. The survival thing, it's a complicated one because, you know, I remember my younger self trying to play a game and do what was expected of me. And I knew pretty quickly that wasn't where I wanted my life to go. And it meant that certain people who I respect had enabled me with helping me survive weren't going to be appropriate because what I want from painting isn't, look, we live in this world at the moment. I mean, I'll try and get the elephant out of the room. It's a bit like X Factor, right? And it's like, who's this season's kind of contestant? And that's fine, right? But you're not going to get Bob Dylan doing that. And you're not going to get anybody who's that interesting playing that game. And I've been, you know, when I won the ICA Futures in 2001, you know, there was a queue of people waiting for work and, you know, and it was a great moment. And I was living in Rome, you know, I was going and looking at Caravaggio and I won loads of money. And I was probably awful. I probably thought I was the best thing since sliced bread. And then one day I woke up and I thought, I'm not, because this thing's kind of drifted away from me and I need to kind of claim it back. And the process of doing that created a lot of problems. And though, I mean, I remember going into the Royal College and talking to a student. The first thing they said in the morning was, how do I get a gallery? And then I knew that the time was up for me teaching because, you know, when I was at art school, it, like I said before, it was full of people, whether they were from Eton or, you know, Leytonstone, there was this brilliant openness and everyone was there because they validated their position through the work that they did. And now it's not like that. It's like you're there because you can pay to be there. And those kids who, like myself at the time, I mean, look, I've been to 6 art schools. I wouldn't have gone to any if I was a young person now. Mm. And it's a bit of a personal kind of mission for me because I think it's really bad and I think we're going to end up with a very myopic culture if we're not careful because all the gatekeepers are kind of middle class men and all the artists that are coming out are kind of quite well-off kids. And it's like, well, where are the kids from places like, you know, Russell?
Where's the Romford boys? Where
yeah,
are they?
Where are the Romford boys? And it does make me really concerned. I mean, I think what Tracy Emin's doing with her Academy Art School thing is hats off to her. I think that is just phenomenal. If you know, thank
and
God.
I was thinking about that, Tim, because I've been hanging out a lot with the students. There's about 10 of them. And then also there's about 11 professional artists. But actually the whole group of those artists, like all 20 odd of them, they're just not like what you're talking about. You know, they're kind of like, it's like old school. Mm. And they're all talking about art every day and critiquing each other's work, but like quite brutally in some, you know, there's quite a lot of emotions running wild at the moment. And it's kind of, it's great because it's passion and they all really love art. And actually they are all quite odd human beings. Like each and every one of them, you know, they're fantastic. They are the weirdos.
Yeah,
like that Radiohead song
or
something.
I'm all about the weirdos.
But I know, but that's also what I've always been about. Like, and I love that. And I'm really invigorated by that. And I don't know. It's just,
well, Patrick
it is Heron, lost.
He wrote this article in, I think it was 1973, called The Murder of the Art Schools. And what was interesting about it was that generation of people, even people like Paul Huxley, who taught me, bless him, he said, I don't know how you kids can paint in this environment. And this was when we got grants. This is when our fees were paid. And this is when we had our own studios. And this is like the Brexit conundrum thing, right? I'm doing my best work on the back of Brexit being a kind of life wrecker. But suddenly there's loads of really good painters around and all the art schools are screwed. And so I'm having this real sort of ideological crisis. It's like, do us humans just need to constantly have something to fight against to make really good art?
Yes.
And if we sit on our arses being a bit too comfortable, is that really the problem? And, you know, I'm completely at a loss with it now because it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of depoliticized me, which has at least enabled me to think about painting in a kind of rather sort of strange way, like kind of fan. Like I'm a fan of nature. I never thought I'd be saying that about myself, even a few years ago.
So being devil's advocate then, so if you're not looking for a gallerist, you're not looking for a gallery to represent you currently, do you have ambitions like places you want to show? Do you want to show in institutions around the world, or are there certain venues or certain things or conversations you want to be involved in when it comes to exhibiting your work? Like you want to be seen alongside de Kooning, for example, or you want to be seen alongside Lee Krasner in that conversation. Do you have those ambitions?
I'd quite like to be next to David Bomberg somehow. But, okay, you know, the problem with David Bomberg is that he died of malnutrition. And, you know, when I see a painting of his go at auction for, what, 4 million quid or whatever the other months, and I think of the poor bugger dying of hunger. You know, somebody the other day was talking about how the market sorts it all out in the end. And I thought, well, that sorts it out for everyone else, but not the bloody artist. Because, you know, he died of malnutrition and now his paintings are 4 million quid. And there's a kind of injustice in that is a bigger thing than me or what I do. And I've probably got a bit of that because of what I said before about my kind of upbringing and stuff. But what's my answer to that question? I think that I don't write off working with anyone. I think the issue is working with people who have a level of empathy and understanding and insight that means that when you talk to them about enabling or positioning your work, that they kind of get it. And you're not just a sort of checkbook for them, or they're not just a step on a ladder for you. I mean, there's an awful lot of that. And, you know, obviously, you know, I respect all the people that I've worked with because they've all given me opportunities to present my work, and I wouldn't say it any other way. But, you know, sometimes I think it's good to believe that, and I don't mean this in an arrogant way, but that as an artist, you're ahead of the curators. Like, it's up to them to come round. Like you, they're not making the art. You know, the big thing that's happened in my lifetime as an artist is the rise of the professional curator. Mm. And just for the record, I just think there's too many of them. And, you know, like, I the curators that I like, people like Catherine Lambert, I like people like, you know, oh, God, I've been talking too long. What's his name who wrote the Francis Bacon books, the interviews? David Sylvester, John Richardson, people like that, proper old school people who were about the artist. The thing that's going on now is a lot of curators are using the art to prop them up. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, knock that off. Like, you don't make the work. It's not about you. And I'm just not interested in that. And we all know who those people are. And if they never ever talk to me, it honestly wouldn't bother me.
But it's career. It's their career essentially, and it's like box ticking, and they need to sort of advance themselves within that structure. And that's also something. Having moved here, I just feel like we've all stepped off that, and I'm so relieved. And actually, the Turner Contemporary here now has Clary Wallace, and Clary's one of the people that I feel actually does really listen to artists. Mm. Has been in most people's studios, really cares about the artist, and she's not, it's not really about her. I think she's bringing in younger curators that also really care about the art. And even talking with them recently, I'm really enjoying spending time with them because they actually care about art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And even Russell and I know it's quite pop, you know, the world that we've created in a way, but that's kind of deliberate because it's a way of reaching more people, and trying to platform it. But at the same time, we love art and we love
artists. Totally get that. I listened to a brilliant BBC podcast with Steve Coogan the other day, and he was talking about how success enabled him to do what he wanted to do. And, you know, that's the dream. That's like me saying about standing in front of the canvas without anything and just putting the brush on it and it happening, you know, having that idea that, you know, you can have that level of authorship about your own life. And obviously that's an this comes back to me being kind of le petit bourgeoisie, you know, it's just a completely ridiculous luxury. And, you know, people have called it everything. They've called it selfish. They've called it self-indulgent. They've called it narcissistic. They call it introspective.
Stubborn.
Everything you want. But the thing is, it's like, tell me something creative where somebody hasn't just traveled through the depths of, I mean, I rewatched Raging Bull the other night, and I mean, Robert De Niro, he's an artist, you know, like what he did in that film wasn't just acting. And what I want to do in my painting, it's not just about paint, you know, there's got to be this other layer of stuff. And I'm interested in what that all those other layers are, you know, and how deep they can go. And listen, I might not, people might look at my paintings and go, well, he's talking rubbish. I don't see any of it. And that's fine. I mean, I'm not making them for anyone else. That's the thing I want to be clear about. I'm only making them for me. And if other people don't get it, tough.
But really, have you heard of that book that's just come out by Christopher Neave called Immortal Thoughts?
No.
So I think he's a painter, and he's obviously written a number of books in the past about art. But there's this brand new book, it came out last week, and it's called Late Style in the Time of Plague. And it's all about, I think it's got like 19 artists that he talks about, from like Gwen John to like Michelangelo, Cezanne, Bonnard, Mirandi, Poussin. Wow. And it's all about their last work before they died. And he's sort of analyzing all of their last moments in their work. So maybe like the last five
things.
There's
the Van Gogh in there, that the crows in the field. That was the last one he did.
I haven't read
it?
The whole thing yet. Yeah, maybe.
There's a famous letter that, I don't know if it's famous, but there's a letter that Cezanne wrote to his son 2 weeks before he died in 1906. And he said to his son, I failed miserably. I never did anything interesting with colour. And, you know, the reason I find that interesting and the reason I'm going to check this book out is because another part of the conversation about painting is a conversation about skepticism, right? And we live in a world now where if you ask questions, if you're a skeptic, people go, well, that's a bit difficult, or that's not a good way to present yourself, or that's not slick packaging. And it's that world that Bill Hicks described when he said, if you want to fuck something up, stick a dollar sign next to it. And it's like, you know, the world has become Gucci-fied. You know what I mean? And the thing about that letter that Suzanne wrote, even though probably all the people that own Suzanne's mint surrounding Gucci all the time, is that what he's saying is that he was doubting himself until 2 weeks before he died.
Wow.
And he was really the most... I think he changed art more than anybody, even more than Van Gogh, actually. I think Cézanne really was the painter that took painting from the 18th century to the 20th century. He was the... And I always think, what would have happened if Cézanne had lived 10 years longer, you know, because obviously sort of cubism started to happen around 1915, 14, and, you know, you had people like Kahnweiler showing Picasso's work, and you just kind of think, God, if only Cézanne had had that extra 10 years, like Van Gogh. You know, I mean, we talked about survival, the big question. That, I mean, I lived in the Netherlands. He's Van Gogh, you know. I mean, he was completely unloved and unwanted.
I was talking to someone the other day, this really reminds me of a conversation where it was about the privilege of insecurity as an artist, and she was saying that she... Wow. Hates what she does, and she's like a humongous star, and I won't say names, but she has crippling self-doubt and doesn't think she's good enough, but she was able to see it as a privilege that she felt that, because it made her work harder and it made her keep going. And I guess what you're saying about Cézanne makes me feel like if he was unaware of what he was doing for art, what he was doing for art history in general, he was in insular with it and just pushing himself and at odds with himself to prove to himself, and that's what made him a good artist, and that's what makes good artists. If you ever sit back and go, you know what, I've got this covered, I'm a great actor, I can do anything, I'm a great singer, I'm a great writer, whatever I do, I could have a shit and it could sell for this, then you're fucked, aren't you? Whatever
Unless
level
you're
you are artist,
Zony.
Right, and then you put it in a can, yeah. But whatever level you're at, is like, as long as you have, there is a privilege in still needing to prove to yourself that you're worth that. I think there's a good spin on that.
Well, self-worth is it's a very complicated thing again. Mm. And I mean, whoever said that to you, I totally agree with, by the way. And actually, this is what I mean about what's kind of going on at the moment and why I feel more inclined towards the conversations now than I did, say, during YBA, because this is not a YBA conversation. This is kind of what I'm getting at. And the thing about the identifying the, you know, doubt or, you know, kind of almost self-loathing is a valuable part of particularly painters' identity. Comes back to this thing again of what I was saying about whether you want to make paintings and instruct the painting, or whether you want the painting to instruct you. And, you know, like, it's the difference between delivering a painting or finding a painting. And if you're delivering a painting, you can have that kind of hardness, you know. You can go, yeah, I don't have any self-doubt. I need to contain that in order to make this kind of process, in order to make the painting happen. But if you do the other sort of painting where you're trying to find it, then, you know, you've got to be bulletproof, because it's gonna beat you up, and some people just can't deal with that. And I mean, I'm not sure if I can, but I still do it. But I think that that's the difference now, that I think that there are more painters who are adept at navigating these very complex concerns about how to find resolution through a kind of almost chaotic process than having one which is like straight.
Streamlined, yeah.
Yeah,
before we get on to our final questions, I just want to circle back to the people that called you a class traitor and a petty bourgeoisie. Did you win them round in the end? Did these people support you and follow your practice? And I guess this was friends and family members, was it? Or
I have no interest even in knowing if I did or didn't. It's not my domain. That's their perception of the world. That's not mine, and it's not my job to convince anybody to think that I won or whatever that might mean, or they lost, or that I'm a good painter or I'm not a good painter. I don't give a monkey's about any of that. It's like, what I care about is people, and I care more about you know, things like being nice now than I did when I was younger. I think, you know, I can kind of see a lot of the things that I did when I was younger and how they kind of got me where I was. And now I maybe have a bit more of a kind of platonic view of that. But when I'm in the studio, I'm completely kind of wrapped up in it. So I have a sort of structure that allows me to cope, basically. But if I listen too much about what other people said, particularly in places like the art world or amongst gallerists or critics or whatever, I'd never come in my studio because, you know, it hurts, you know, and it's not just me that thinks that. I think every artist feels like that because, you know, we do take it personally, and we take it personally because we mean what we do if we're really doing it the way that it's meant to be done.
You're the best. This has been incredible. So we're going to get to our final questions now. This is going to be really interesting. If you could do an art heist, although you have mentioned Guernica, if you could do an art heist and you could steal any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
You know what? You mentioned Guernica, and I'd only do it just to see how big the vehicle I'd have to have to do that with me. I'd say what I'm going to reverse it, right? The heist would be me being allowed to go and see the paintings in Werner Herzog's Cave of Forgotten Dreams. So it would be about you taking me to that rather than me taking the paint, because I can't go and see those paintings. No one can.
Explain what this all is.
The Cave of Forgotten Dreams is by Werner Herzog, who is like my favourite human in the world. And I love that guy. And the film is about the paintings made in these caves in France that were only discovered recently. And the thing that's so amazing about them, apart from the fact that they're, I think, 45,000 years old and the best drawings that you ever see in life, is that we don't know who made them. We don't know even their kind of racial sort of dynamics, you know, even if they were part Neanderthal, we don't know if they were men or women. So they're kind of elevated above all of the conversations that we think art is about at the moment. And I just think that, you know, would be an amazing thing to see because, you know, art existed before society, and you could argue that society was born out of art because before those paintings were made in caves and people were nomadic, we didn't have a system where some people worked so that other people could paint. And it was people painting and stopping becoming nomadic and then the agrarian culture developing that means we're here today. So those things are the most important pieces of art, and I wouldn't take them out of the caves because I couldn't, but I'd like to take myself there.
I love that answer. Why can no one ever visit there? Is it all just sealed
because
off?
Because human breath ruins the moisture amount or absorbency of pigments on the walls and soda lights. I mean, there's a cave near me in southern Spain called La Cueva de la Pileta, which has got a painting of a fish that's 25,000 years old. And I go there occasionally and have a little look at this fish.
Breathe on it.
Well, he's desperate to erase it.
Yeah, it's your practice. You're like, erase it.
You're the eraser.
Oh, we just start again. See what's underneath the fish. What's underneath the fish, guys?
Well, what's underneath the fish is another cabin with a painting of a pregnant horse. But you're not allowed to go and see the pregnant horse because of that. And wow. I want to see the pregnant horse.
So the film crew went in with Werner Herzog and just documented everything, and then they sealed it up didn't they?
They allow people in there for like 2 weeks a year.
Yeah, you
to document it and then
you
go.
You can go if you're really, really lucky. And but I think the film is online. I think you can even watch it.
Yeah, no, the film's available.
Like,
and
YouTube.
I think he did it with like 3D cameras.
That's it.
Yeah. So that you could watch it in 3D.
Yeah.
I think, wasn't it like 2011?
Yeah, something like that. But you know, it's also got his very brilliant sort of dry voice narrating it. Yeah. And I just think it's incredible. And, it, you know, you immediately think of that thing Picasso said when he saw the, apparently, we never know if these stories are true, when he saw the paintings in Lascaux and he was asked, you know, what did you think? And he just said, we've learned nothing. Which is a bit harsh. I think we've learned a bit, Pablo.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Now, I know you do, because I listen, and I thought about this a lot, right? And I thought, oh, no, I've got a really smart-ass answer to that, which is that colours can never exist in isolation, right? So, like, if you have the same blue on black and then put it on white, it's a different blue. So I thought, oh, that's because I'm so obsessed with the contextual relationships between colours. But then I thought, I'm going to compromise and say claret and blue. And Russell will know why, because I'm a West Ham supporter.
I am. You don't start me on football. I have no idea about football, but I understand.
Russell really knows.
No, but well, he's from Essex. The thing is that I sort of, maybe my love of, you know, my favourite colour probably is colour called Old Holland cadmium violet, which is also like the most expensive colour. It's like the colour that only the king was allowed to wear in the Middle Ages, and if anybody wore it, they'd be executed. It's like the most expensive colour. And
wasn't cadmium the most toxic colour paint for
The cadmiums are also really like kind of horrifically dangerous.
Let royalty wear it then.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. What is the best advice that you have ever received when it comes to your art?
God. Okay. I never received it, but I read it, and it was Nietzsche. People are turning off now I've said that. They probably turned off about an hour ago. Nietzsche said, to he whom seeks advice, remember you are always on the path of another and not yet on a path of your own. Ooh. So that would be my advice. Never seek advice.
Have your own advice.
We've never had that one. I love that. I agree with that.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
And actually, that's so much, that actually sums up the work that you've been making recently, because I feel like, I was saying to Russell, I just saw him in Derek Jarman's Blue in Margate the other day.
Yeah.
And I said to Russ, it's one of the best performances Russ ever gave.
And it was a voiceover.
Because, it's not because of that. Let me
fucking finish
horrible
then.
Human
on.
Being. No, because I feel like Russell's getting to a point in his acting where he's starting to strip everything back and he's losing himself and he's becoming the words. He's becoming like the role. And I think that's what great art is. I think often it's about getting to the, you know, the deepest part of oneself in order to connect the story or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's a kind of really complicated thing, but that's actually why I also mentioned that book by Christopher Neave, because I think it's got to do with, like, I love that idea of like the final moments of an artist's life and what it all boils down to and that kind of studying of that. And he was talking a lot about intuition and memory and how you almost go back to where you started or something.
I think
so
that's
like,
right.
Which is all this idea of like stripping back all the layers. And that's what I like. That's why I mentioned in the intro as well about palimpsest, because it's this idea that you can write over history, you can add and erase. And but at the
that's
end of the day,
the painting
you kind of
that took me the longest amount of time, the one that I gave that title to, that actually was about 13 years. Wow. So there's a belated answer. But I mean, Russell, you'll know this. I mean, you know, you're the real artist in this conversation. you've got to feel it, haven't you? I mean, this is the bottom line with it. You can sell a painting for £1 million, or you can be in a Hollywood film, or you can do all of these things, right? But it comes back to like what I'm saying about, you know, like Bonnard doing those paintings of his wife, and then there's that story that when she died, they like had to come round and force him to give her body up because he was sort of still painting her. Because he was so kind of like in the role. Mm. And, you know, the thing again with De Niro sort of saying, no, I'm not going to wear prosthetics. I'm going to eat 10 hamburgers a day until I'm a big fat bastard. And so that when I act, I know what it's like to be kind of grotesque, because I can't understand the grotesque unless the grotesque possesses me. And I think that's all you can try and do when you're an artist, in a way, is kind of give yourself up to the feeling and hope that you're getting near it, because it is like trying to hit a bullseye in a pitch black room at times, and you're not quite sure whether you did or not. It's always hindsight that lets you maybe know that thing.
Brilliant. So where can we, you are on social media. I know that, so people can follow you. You say
that. I'll probably get loads of unfollows.
Not at all. I don't think so. I think this has actually been such a wonderful conversation. I think clear.
I've had a brilliant conversation, and I think you two guys, I said this to you before, Russell, I think you guys are creating a really valuable archive that is really necessary. And, you know, what I love about this new media that old farts like me didn't have when we were young is that I can go online and I can watch the program that made me become an artist when I was 13, this program of Tom Keating on paintings. And there's only about 9 of them. And if I ever kind of lose interest in painting, I go and I Google Tom Keating on painting, and I watch that lovely old bugger do a copy of a Monet, because he was brilliant. He was a brilliant forger, and it's there. It's online, and you're adding to that in another way. This rich pool of stuff that means that, you know, even though education has spoiled the potential for so many working class kids because of the way that it's been structured, that there is this other thing that people can go to and they can learn an enormous amount. And I'm very grateful that you've asked me to contribute towards that. And I hope my contribution has some sort of value.
100%.
Oh, I've loved it. I've loved every minute. I've actually been really quiet because I've just been taking in everything.
Yeah, sorry. Don't I go on?
No,
I love it.
It's beautiful.
I could stay for another few hours. So, yeah. So this is just part one, maybe.
So your Instagram is at Tim Stoner.
No, it's Stoner Tim. Stoner Tim, yeah.
And then if people want to see your work in the flesh, you are in some collections that people can go and see you in. Do you know, or do you have exhibitions lined up or anything that people can...
What have I got lined up? I did have a couple of things in the pipeline, and for some reason I've sort of forgotten about them. Well, I will obviously post them on my Instagram if they materialise. But at the moment, I'm really enjoying just being in my studio, having really interesting conversations with people like yourself and other artists. And really, you know, I kind of think all this is really about is that, you know, people talk about subject matter, people talk about all kinds of things around art, but we're alive, we can do something about it, we can add to the conversation. And actually the best subject matter is the fact that we're here now doing it and experiencing it. And that, for me, is what it's really all about, not the other stuff.
Mm. Amazing.
Hear, hear. Well, on that note, we'll be back very soon. And Tim Stoner, thank you so much.
Tim.
You can follow him at Stoner Tim.
Thank you.
And you can also see images on our Instagram at TalkArt. And Tim, email me your postal address because I'm going to post you the book.
Okay, yeah.
Can't wait. Because I think you're going to love it.
Okay.
I'm going to get you a signed copy because he's like 90 or something, the writer, I think.
No.
And he's had to sign them on book plates. Russ and I were at Hatchard's and the guy at Hatchard's, Richard, was showing us the book and he was like, isn't it exquisite? Because he hates book plates, the guy at Hatchard's.
No.
But he was saying because this artist was so elderly, he loved that he'd made the effort to like sign the book plates.
Yeah.
It's really cool. I'm going to post it to you.
Old
to send me your address
always.
To say thank you for this wonderful education. I've loved it.
Thank you.
And we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening,
everyone.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.